Hey, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Today is October 31st, Halloween! Halloween! And this episode is brought to you by El Cajon Harley. How great are these guys, man? El Cajon Harley, the finest Harley-Davidson dealer in the United States. My favorite, located in El Cajon, California. Check out their website, elcajonharley.com, right now. Maybe you want to trade in your bike or maybe just sell your bike. They've got to value your trade-in in 60 seconds right on the website. Need extra cash or a new bike? Just click on the website and they'll tell you exactly what they'll give you for the bike. And boom, you're on your way. It's that easy. Also, they have a will not be beat on their tire price sale going on right here. All the time, they have the lowest price tires guaranteed. Guaranteed. El Cajon Harley, man. Well, it's just a fantastic sponsor. I love having a sponsor that I enjoy, like motorcycles, you know? And El Cajon Harley's been nothing but gold to me. So cool. You want to check out their used bike selection? It's incredible. Go to their website. You can click on See More Inventory. They've got all kinds of bikes online. Or go down there and test ride one. Ask for my boy, Greg Riley. Check him out, elcajonharley.com. Or hit him on Instagram, Facebook. All of it, El Cajon Harley, or just walk into the shop and say, hey man, I'm here to test ride a bike. Check them out, El Cajon Harley. It's a special day here on Let There Be Talk. Let's see here. I want to look this up, actually, because I have I don't really know exactly when it was. And what I'm talking about is when I started this podcast. I know it was about 4 years ago, maybe longer. Let me look real quick on iTunes. Let's see here. Since 2012. And today is episode number 300, which is pretty fucking crazy when I think back to it. Somebody was just tweeting at me recently like, hey man, what's your favorite episode? And every episode, actually, as cheesy as that sound, is my favorite because it means that I'm doing an episode of Let There Be Talk. It means I've got somebody on the couch that I have been inspired by, or I think that it's just a fantastic human. And so, like I said, every one of my guests has been great, starting all the way back to the first one with Mr. Mike Beach, a great friend of mine, always been there for me. I love him. He said, I'll do it first. And, you know, that was July 19th, 2012. So it's been a long, hard working road, but all fucking worth it, man. I love this podcast. I love you people that tune in. I remember just having like two listeners starting out, and the next week it was like 32, and then it got bigger and bigger. And over the years, it's just been such a great ride. Such a great ride, man. I look back at some of the people I had here. Allison Mosshart from The Kills, just insane. Jerry, my boy from Devo. Who else was just, you know, things you don't think is going to happen. Mark Lanigan. I mean, come on. Some great, fantastic comedians like Bill Burr and Dave Lombardo together talking drums. Mark Ford from the Black Crowes and Rich Robinson. It goes on and on and on. And then, of course, the handmade episodes are starting to be some of my favorite episodes because it's really not about, it's not about, the podcast was never really about having celebrities on or rock stars or whatever. It was just people that did cool stuff that I believe. And especially people that make stuff with their hands, like West Coast Boots and all these episodes over the last couple of years of the handmade stuff is I dig it. And I can tell by the emails that you guys dig it, which is fucking cool, man. Anyway, long-winded, I just wanted to really say thank you. This is number 300 coming up, and today is no exception. Another amazing episode. What I really want to say before I even tell you who the guest is in 1979, I saw Kiss at the Cow Palace on the Dynasty Tour. And, you know, right when I walked in, if anybody listens from San Fran and used to go to the Cow Palace, the way it worked was you'd go through these front doors. There was about 10 doors, and it was just really one entrance to the Cow Palace with like about 10, 15 doors. Over the years, I'd seen people just fucking storm them. It was amazing, man. Like, you know, back then, the security was a little light. A guy would be like, ticket, and people just go, boom, and run in. And if you got by the ticket guy and through the front doors and down the ramp of the Cow Palace and just drifted immediately into the crowd, you were in, man. But my point is, the Cow Palace, walking in as a kid, walked in, gave the ticket. Mom takes me to see Kiss. Go with a buddy, Sean's. And right when we walk in, there it is, man. The merch table. And I'd never, you know, even seen a concert shirt because, as we talk about on this episode, concert shirts were not something you could get like at Target or fucking, you know, Urban Outfitters or Hot Topic. None of that shit existed. You needed to go to the show and to get a shirt. And if you got that shirt, it was like a fucking medal at school the next day. I wore it. Yep, that's right. I was at Kiss and they'd be, whoa, what was it like? And I got off on that storytelling, which is probably where I am these days with podcasting and stuff, starting back into school, of like, yeah, they came on, they had these outfits and they floated up from underground in these boxes. And like Gene had a cape and he flew and spit fire and blood and Ace shot shit from his guitar. And it was just, the show was monumental, but just as big to me was that merch table. And I'll never forget the first merch table. They had the shirts up. There was like three. You always had a jersey. They always had a fucking jersey, a baseball jersey, three-quarter sleeve. And then they would have a black T-shirt. And then they would have some other funky one. And then maybe about 90% of the time, a tour book, which I always bought because you could cut it up and then hang it in your room. Which I regret now, cutting these tour books up because they're fucking fortunes on eBay. But there it was, the first shirt. I think it was $6.50, maybe $7, the shirt at the time. And my mom got it for me. And I wore that thing every fucking day to school, like a lunatic. Over and over, all day, all year, wearing this. Before that, before this concert, I never owned a concert shirt. There was no concert shirts. It was like OP, Ocean Pacific. That was the stuff. A shirt with an OP on it. You bought it at Mervyn's. It was the first brand, you know, or Miller's Outpost. Anybody remember that place? But Mervyn's, man. My mom, we were light on paper, and we'd go down on a week before school would start, and I'd get like two outfits and a pair of shoes and I would have this quote unquote school clothes and then the after school clothes. And I remember I would wear bell bottoms and I didn't have a chain guard and it would just rip a perfect triangle out of my pants. My mom would be like, "You didn't change your school clothes." Anyway, from that day in 1979, I put on a concert shirt. And I've been wearing nothing but concert shirts to right now, 2016. and I'm 50 years old. I wear the same clothes I did from that day. Usually a flannel or some kind of leather jacket, or back then a derby jacket. You can Google that. That was big in the Bay Area. And then jeans and a shirt, sneakers or boots. It's been the same thing my entire life, and I could never really wear a suit. I respect suits. I love some bands that wear suits, but it's just not me. Concert shirt is what it is. And that's a long, long-winded way to get to who my guest is today. My guest today has a company that has absolutely fucking blown my mind. And I've seen a lot of cool shit in my life. And I've seen a lot of people with passion, all these people with passion that make stuff by hand. Of course, they have to have passion, because to make something by hand or to be an artist, it's only about the love, you know. Brian the Bootmaker, let's say, I had him on, 24 years old. He's a cobbler. Come on, man. You know? But my point is, my man today, Blaine Halverson, he has a company called Made Worn. Now, I want you to check it out. Maybe before you even start the episode, go to his Instagram and start realizing what this guy's about. Because this guy's passion is fucking next level, man. Next level. I love concert shirts. This guy is beyond. He loves them so much that he wanted to figure out a way. Instead of buying shirts these days on eBay for $300, $400, $500, and that's what these shirts go for, because they're pieces of art now. These shirts, these Iron Maiden shirts, these early Judas Priest shirts, Zeppelin, Stones, Boston, Kiss, stuff that's very rare. Early Van Halen, the Fair Warning shirt. I still own it right now. These shirts are pieces of art, and they go for big money, and they're always way too small now to wear. So this man seeked out, and fully for the passion of it, to make an ultimate reproduction of a concert shirt. And I'm not talking about these ones you see at Hot Topic or Urban Outfit, none of that. That stuff, that's fine or whatever, you know, but this is something way beyond. Those shirts at those outlet stores and stuff, they're on some kind of thick thing. They're not fitted. They look new. Of course, I don't like the new shirts. A lot of people are into beefy shirts, beefy tees, that kind of stuff. That was big in the 90s. I don't like that stuff. All my merch is printed on pretty thin shirts, mostly because I live in California and I don't like thick shirts because they're just too fucking hot on me. And also, I love how a thin shirt looks. It looks old and see-through-y and shit. That's all part of it. And I know I sound like a lunatic, but that's all part of it. An old beat up concert shirt. So I walk into this man's compound in Hollywood and my fucking head falls off. Because when I say somebody is next level, I'm not like sitting here like I'm some kind of a fucking a master of all things, but there is a couple things I know about, and one of them is concert shirts. When I saw this guy's concert t-shirts, I just couldn't fucking believe it. My brain, it was a sensory overload, man. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. Right in front of me was the very first Kiss shirt that I ever owned, and he had a reproduction of it that looked and felt exact to the fucking shirt I bought at the Cow Palace in 1979. And I put it on, and I've had it on for 6 fucking days right now. I'm a lunatic, but I realize at the end of the day, you know, you could own thousands of things, or you could own hundreds, or, you know, multiple items. But I think at the end of the day, I am a pretty simple man, just some good concert shirts, a good pair of jeans, a great flannel or leather, and I'm fucking happy. And I got to remind myself that as I put on this Kiss shirt, I'm like, I'm cool with this shirt. I'll just wear it till it falls off. So number 300, this episode, I feel this is a perfect fucking guest because it combines rock and roll and handmade and passion, which I think that's everything this podcast is about to me. It's all three in one, man. And this guy is fucking the man. And I'm going to bring him on in a minute. Before I do, I want to thank each and every one of you guys that have ever listened to this podcast. It just blows my mind when someone comes up to me and shakes my hand and says, man, I love your podcast. If I'm in New York or Indianapolis or fucking, you know, Seattle or Toronto or anywhere I'm at, and somebody comes up, a total stranger, and goes, dude, I love your podcast. It makes all this fucking work worth it. And that's why this podcast is late right now. Here it is. It's Monday night at 11 o'clock, and I'm doing the intro. I just flew in from a weekend in San Jose with Russell Peters, which, by the way, thank you, Russell Peters, for an incredible weekend. I love that man, and I love everybody that was at the San Jose Improv. All the people that worked there are just such cool people. Anyway, I flew in. I've got to get it up. Of course, it's late, but I'm the only guy that does this podcast. I'm the guy that books the guests. I'm the guy that records them. I'm the guy that edits them. I'm the guy that posts them up. There's no agents. There's nobody lining the guests. There's no one doing all the post-production or the pre-production. It's all me. So when I get it up, it's a miracle sometimes that I get this thing out every Monday and Thursday. So thanks for your patience and thanks for all your great emails. Please keep leaving reviews and posting some likes there on iTunes. And what else? Oh, come see me tonight, which would be Tuesday night by now, at the Comedy Store, me, Josh Wolf, and the incredible Joey Diaz. I love Joey, speaking of rock and roll addicts like myself, and Josh Wolf, a great friend. I want you to listen to an episode of his podcast that I just did that's out today. We get pretty deep. And I really enjoyed talking to this guy. Josh Wolf is an incredible funny man, and he will be a guest coming up on Let There Be Talk soon. But go check out the episode I did with him. I think you're going to enjoy it. Tonight at the store, Belly Room, please come down. I'm going to be running a long set and see what you guys think. And all week, I'll be all over town. By the way, Josh's podcast is called Fairly Normal. I'll be all over town this week. I'm home. And then Sacramento Punchline, come see me in November, which it is now. Rent is due. November 10, 11, 12. And December, I'll be at the San Francisco Punchline, December 15th, 16th, 17th. I'm going to get into this episode. Enjoy it. Thank you so much. Here it is, number 300. Let's get into it with a little Made Worn. All right, here we are, another episode of Let There Be Talk. This is a handmade episode, and I've got the king of handmade right here. Introduce yourself.
Hey, it's Blaine Halverson. Hope everyone's good.
Owner of Made Worn.
Yes.
Here, everybody knows I'm obsessed with rock concert t-shirts. And I got to say, you have the best rock t-shirts ever to be made.
Thank you.
Now you make these rock t-shirts. My buddy Patrick turned me on to them. And I was like, oh, my God. These are exact vintage. How did you get into this?
You know, I've been collecting rock tees for probably 20 years, I guess. Always been a fan of that sort of nostalgia, people taking those tees home, and started collecting because I liked, you know, obviously you could always tell the people that loved their tees just by the amount of times they've been washed and the wear and tear and so forth. So I started, you know, I always had this affinity to want to kind of chase and be able to sort of recreate as close to what those vintage tees were like. So, you know, I created a company back in the day called Junk Food, which was obviously a little bit lower end, but it was, you know, it was kind of the beginning of the whole conceptual idea of just making a vintage tee to begin with.
I remember those. They were like, they were just kind of like $20 shirts.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it was like, you know, you're like that 40 to 60 range. So it was right. Like right when the stores like Hot Topic and stuff were like, they were starting to expand and get big and so forth. So we sort of, you know, put together basically a vintage tee. You know, prior to that, there wasn't really that idea out there. So I wanted to have a tee that people could buy. You know, that it's common today, but you know, back then it was kind of a big deal. It, like, you know, looked like someone had worn it a lot, you know.
Yeah.
So you could go to a retail store and buy basically a new tee that, you know, at least felt like it was a little bit older and loved and soft and so forth, and built, you know, a big licensed sort of grouping around that. And I think 99, you know, I started working with the Stones and Pink Floyd and AC/DC, and then kind of expanded, obviously, you know, from there.
How did you when you're first starting out, how do you get a hold of these people? Do you get a hold of their marketing people, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, this one was an odd one, because I was actually in New York, and funny enough, I actually went weirdly to get my nails done at this like little place where they like gave great hand massages.
Yeah.
And I actually sat next to this this gentleman named Norman Perry, who, you know, from like I think age 17, he basically had like he was like the number one promoter in Canada. So he's who brought the Stones and Floyd and everyone there, and then went on to basically represent them. And so I sat next to him and basically kind of told him what I was, you know, what I was doing and yada yada. I mean, super random, two dudes in a fucking nail salon.
That's so crazy.
And anyway, that was it. Like, we hit it off, and I basically signed that deal, and we kind of went from there.
You mean you tell him what you're doing, he sees it and likes it, and then start, and then you get a
yeah. I mean, a lot of those, you know, back then, you know, we were getting to be pretty well known, and you know, I was getting in the licensing world
with Junk Food.
We were doing a lot of the big corporate licenses. So, I mean, people knew about us. We were definitely had a lot of traction, and especially in the like better boutiques, you know, we were like the first licensed t-shirt to get into like the Fred Segals and things of the world. So people knew at that point. So he knew of who we were.
Right. Where I started seeing it, Fred Segal.
Yeah. And then in, you know, in 2005, we took that company public, and I left in 2010. And then in like 2013, I went and spent a bunch of time in Japan, and sort of had that itch to really create that a much higher product, and really be more of like a pet project,
right?
Of really trying to see how close I could get to really kind of knitting that old feel of what a rock tee was. Well, because back then most of those tees were like, you know, it's still today. It's the mechanism hasn't really changed. You know,
yeah.
Bands are buying they're basically buying the cheapest t-shirt there is in the market, and printing it with the worst ink so that they get the most profit at tour. I mean, most people probably don't want to hear that, but that's the reality of it.
Right.
So back then, everyone was buying these screen stars. You know, there was like a handful of tees, but the bulk of the tees that people love, most of the time, if you look at the label, it's screen star.
Yeah.
It was the cheap, shitty blank.
What's weird, because that is what's so sought after, because it was thin, and it was, you know,
it torqued, it tweaked, it did everything that, like, they're not supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah. I call them floaters.
Yeah.
Because the back would float.
Yeah.
You know, like especially the bootleg ones in the parking lot.
Yeah, the seam will completely twist around to the front. That's the good stuff.
Yeah, what the fuck makes them do that, man?
I mean, it's just, it's bad. It's bad everything. Now we try, you know, you basically work backwards. You try to recreate all that stuff. It's complex. So Japan had a lot of the old knitting machines. We went over there and, you know, spent a lot of time like, basically looming different knits together to try to get that hand and feel. And then the ink was the biggest, you know, thing.
Yeah, because they don't make that ink anymore.
Yeah, they don't, you know, back then it was all lead-based ink. So you had the lead allowed the ink to sit on the top of the fabric. Now it's like it all goes in. So it's hard to get that kind of old. It's, today it's like when you print brand new ink and you just hammer it with Plastisol, it just looks like a brand new shirt.
Right.
You know, those old shirts back then, the t-shirt's going to fall apart before the ink's ever going to break down because it's got lead.
Yeah.
But because it sat on top of the shirt, it has a different thing. That's why it kind of breaks. And
that's why it cracked up.
Heals. And so to recreate that, you know, it that was like 18 months of experimenting with like ink manufacturers and trying to figure out like what we could mix into Plastisols to try to get it to kind of recreate what that does. And then it was adjusting like things like, you know, teas go through, you know, you have to cure the ink. So they're going through heaters, readjusting all of that.
Yeah.
So you're like partially under curing the ink, but curing it enough to hold, but doing it so that when we, you know, when we want to try to like hand remove it, because I did, you know, everyone puts distresses on stuff, you know?
Right.
So every shirt looks the same, and it's like...
Yeah, like those ones at like Urban Outfitter and stuff. It just looks out right of the mill.
Yeah, you're just, you know, they're it's just, you know, you go online and you take someone's distress pattern and that's it.
Yeah.
I didn't want that with these, you know? I wanted them to like have that hand nature. So when
that's
we started
amazing.
With Maidworn, when we did all the tees for like Maxfield, we were sanding them on concrete.
Wow.
With bloody knuckles out, like literally sanding the ink to get it to break down and it looked legit, you know. And it also, in doing that, you got the t-shirts to kind of torque and pull like the old ones. But you know, as we grew, yeah, you couldn't just be sitting out in a parking lot on your knees all day fucking sanding on concrete. So, you know, I went back to Japan, spent a bunch of time there trying to like, because they have really amazing different distressing tools. Nothing automated worked, like no little Dremels didn't work. They have these amazing sanding machines that work great on certain fabrics, but t-shirts, because it's lighter weight, it didn't work. So came like, you know, one day in an auto machine place, I grabbed a bunch of the metal brushes that you use to basically take rust off of like tailpipes and shit.
Yeah.
And took that out on concrete and took the like hard edge of those metal things off, and that was it. And since then, every single tee now is still sanded by hand.
Yeah, walk up, you're the owner. And you're fucking working on these shirts yourself, which is like, I mean, that is like severe pride, which I love. Like, you're the fucking owner.
Well, it was one of those things people were like, you know, don't you want to keep all this shit a secret? And in the beginning, I was like, yeah, I guess we should probably keep some of our, like, and then I was like, no fucking person in their right mind's going to do this, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you have to really, like, you have to be, yeah, I mean, somewhat compulsive and, this is just something I take a, you know, it's insane amount of pride in putting out pieces that I'm proud of. And, you know, the growth part of that gets hard because, you're doing more and more of them all the time. But it's still something that, like, you know, I mean, I'm out there with, you know, my guys, and you break a lot of people, you know.
We
probably had 100 guys in here. Like, they'll come in, they'll be like, oh, man, this looks cool. Can I, like, come in and help do this? And,
yeah.
You know. After a couple of hours, they're like, you know, I'm good, you know.
Yeah,
it's like
it gets tedious.
It's a different thing, you know. As you can see, all my fingers are taped up. You know, we were sanding till 11 o'clock last night, and you know, this, like, you know, we use sandpapers too, and you know, no matter how calloused up your hands get, you still take off layers of skin.
It's fucking crazy, man, because the passion is just insane. Because that's the kind of passion I have for rock t-shirts. So much passion. When I walked in yesterday, you had the Dynasty shirt, Kiss Dynasty. It was the first shirt I ever owned. And of course, you seek them on eBay for a long, long time. But, you know, now the XL is really a small in this world.
Yeah.
So when I walked in and saw it, the happiness that it gave me of like, oh my God, that's the first fucking shirt I ever had. And then when I put it on, it feels like the first shirt I ever had. It's thin, it's fucking worn out looking. And it just, I mean, and I know people listening to this, there's a lot of people out there that just go, yeah, that's fucking cool. And other people are like, these guys are lunatics. But it is something to a rock tee, man. It was that thing of wearing it at school. I went to the fucking show.
Yeah.
Back then, you couldn't buy them at the store. You either went to the show and bought a fucking shirt, or you didn't have it.
Yeah.
There was no shirts. There was no stores to go. There was no Hot Topic there. Yeah, give me number 13.
Yeah.
You had to go.
Yeah.
So it was a badge of honor. So, and I wore it till it fell apart. And now I own it again, man.
Yeah, I mean, there's... obviously there's always going to be critics who are like, you know, it no different than like old cars. It's like, don't remake the old car because the old car is what the old car
right.
was. And old concertees, you know, I'm sure there's vintage guys out there that like don't necessarily love that everyone's going and redoing it. But it's like, you know, you still have to have some legacy, you know. Bands want that legacy. So I'm trying to at least keep some of the, like, you know, the integrity that's brought into, you know, the artwork, and really trying to stay truly authentic to what the tees were, you know, were like back then. So well, people who may not have grown up with a lot of these bands, they get to actually get the enjoyment of it, because what's coming out today is not the same. You know, back then you had a handful of artists that probably did the bulk of the artwork.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it all kind of relates and feels, you know, you immediately know an old rock tee. There's nothing else that's like it.
Yeah.
You know, people were printing tees back then, but rock tee had its own thing.
It really did.
It was almost always on a black tee, you know, and it's just, that's what it was.
Yeah.
You know, and
I think the interesting thing really is when you get into merchandise, the 70s was really fucking sleeping on merch, because if you're a collector like myself and you go on eBay and you punch in, let's say, Zeppelin, Boston, Eagles, I'm talking huge fucking bands.
Yeah.
There are no shirts. No. It's really weird. They weren't making fucking shirts, not until around 80. And I really think it was like Van Halen that started making lots of fucking shirts. And once you get into the 80s, all the bands had merch, right? When you went into the concert, there it was. But if you look at early Stones, early Pink Floyd, you can't find any fucking Pink Floyd shirts, even if you wanted to buy one.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, Stones, you know, that's something, obviously, because I've worked with them as long as I have.
Yep.
I've spent my most time basically collecting and searching for the grails out there.
Yeah.
Stuff from the 70s, but the bulk of it's boot.
That's what I'm saying.
Because the reality is back then, bands didn't realize that there was any money in merch.
Yeah.
So a lot of the guys who now run the big merch companies were bootleggers back then.
Yeah.
I mean, the two of the biggest guys that in the merch world that basically oversee these were 16, 17-year-old kids that were bootlegging, and the bands ironically brought them in and were like, you know, hey, why don't you sell this stuff in here? And then, you know, as time grown, there's still bands today that don't see, like, why do merch? They don't, you know, they're like, $1 million, as weird as that sounds, there's bands that are like, we don't need it. We're going to do $300 million on tour. What do we need to deal with a fucking $1 million and so forth for?
Right.
And you also had a lot of bands too that, you know, you didn't have rights to their images. So, you know, a lot of the cool tees back then too are the boots that have the actual images of the bands. Most of the time, those are bootlegs.
Yeah.
It's like someone took a picture, made the t-shirt, but the band may only own the rights to that for like the album. So you see that a lot. That's why you don't see a lot of like the actual pictures of bands on rock tees even today, because in general, most of the bands,
that's crazy,
don't have it.
You know, GNR, we're talking a little bit about that. You work with some of my favorite bands, of course. recently, you did that whole display at the Tower Records on Sunset.
Yeah.
And you started working with GNR. They did one of the most genius things ever. That Appetite Robert Williams shirt was probably the most expensive shirt on eBay for the last 10 years. It'd go for about $350 mint. And they were so smart, they mined their past and put these shirts out. So as I walked into the first show of that tour, which is T-Mobile other than the Troubadour,
yeah,
I walk in, they've got the Robert Williams one. They've got the skull with the needles, you know. They've got Donington. And I'm like, oh, these guys are fucking genius, you know, because those shirts sold through the roof that night.
Yeah.
You know, did you have any word with them on that kind of merch? Did you say you ought to do your old shit?
No, I mean, you know, they kind of had, you know, a lot of bands have, like, Stones have their tongue.
Yeah.
And GNR, they were smart in having that mark. I mean, they had, across their heads, they had those few iconic, like, badges that just work.
Totally.
A lot of bands struggle with that, but GNR hit a couple of home runs with the artwork that they had that went on shirts. So it was just, it made all the sense. You know, they hadn't been out forever, so their whole thing was about
coming back, you know, 20 years later, and like, so I think every part of that tour was kind of built around the idea of like the
nostalgia
of what they were.
It was, I mean, immediately, and they were pretty smart. They were only 45 fucking bucks, so I bought three. I got the fucking jersey with the cross. I got the Robert Williams one, and I own the originals.
Yeah.
But my original ones are absolutely falling apart now, so it's just great. I can keep those.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like, seems to be about the going rate these days on tours, you know.
45.
It's like that $40 to $45 range. Yeah.
Now let's get a little bit about recently. It was you were out there at Old Cella, as a lot of people nicknamed it, and Jagger wore one of your shirts. Now I know Jagger is hands on everything. Did he talk to you at all ever over the years about merch?
I mean with the Stones, you know, obviously working and doing their merch for as long as I have, and the catalog of designs we've done is up in the thousands.
Yeah.
For them, you know, the couple of tees that we did for them for Old Cella really sort of came last minute, because, you know, with the release of their blues album, they asked if I'd do, you know, something kind of representative of the, you know,
right
around that album, so that he could wear it on stage to kind of, for the, because they really kind of announced that they were putting that out. And they'd kept that pretty secret up until that point.
Yeah.
It's like the GNR thing too, you know. I mean, the Tower Records thing, I didn't know I was building that until 72 hours before that.
Wow.
You know? So I had to pull crews from like all over Hollywood to help sort of build that, you know, that crazy bar that we built there. So that seems to be kind of the common. The conversations are always like, hey, we need this, can you pull it off? And, you know, in no time. And obviously, you know, for the Stones, I mean, I could do anything for them. That's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
You know, in the world to design, because there's so many assets. They've done such a brilliant job over the years of retaining their assets. So you just have, as an artist, like an unlimited palette to work with.
My favorite one is that one from, I own it, of course, Jagger's birthday, 78.
Yeah, that
was happy amazing. Birthday on the back, Oakland. It's got the dragon, you know. And
it's one of my favorites as well.
That's an epic shirt.
It's an amazing, amazing shirt. Yeah.
Now, when you're working with these bands, do you say, hey, let's make some of the classic shirts again? And are they cool with that? Or do you do
I mean, I'm pretty much that person. I'm the one who's flying the artwork that no one else has. And
And
part of my thing is building relationships so that that artwork doesn't end up in the Walmarts and things of the world.
Right.
So I'm normally the guy that's going out and finding the stuff that has not been in the market.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to, you know, do things that aren't so like commonplace. And hopefully finding things that people haven't seen, or like only people that were there were like, oh shit, there's that, you know.
Well, this Pink Floyd one right here.
Seen. Yeah. So I try to really find the more rare, you know, pieces that I can tell a bit more of a story around. There's obviously always, you know, there's the idea of like the style guide artwork. It's not really something we do too much of here.
You own all the shirts that you make a version of, right?
Yeah.
That's incredible. How many vintage shirts you own?
I mean, my vintage collection's, I think, up about 15,000 now.
15,000?
Yeah.
Wow. Do you photograph them all?
Yeah, so I started cataloging a couple years ago. And now I'm in the process, I'm going to self-publish, like...
A book?
This, like, encyclopedia, like, alphabetic encyclopedia of, like, what I think the best tees are. From not just my collection and cherry-picking from... You know, for some of my people that I know and other collectors that have pieces that I don't have.
You're going to do like a Toshin's book?
That style, yeah.
Yeah, that's sick.
Because no one's really done, like, no one's done the, like, sort of, you know, the history of the rock tee and span across all the different genres. And so I want to do it to where it's, you know, it comes in volumes and it's broken down so you can really kind of see the bulk of it. Because there's so many amazing ones, and I think it's something that should be cataloged, because it's, you know, listen, there's some of those tees there's only a couple of, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I have tees that like this, I mean, like there's the old, like even just Woodstock, like staff tees and things.
Yeah, you got
like
a Woodstock shirt.
I gave out to just, you know, probably a couple of people. You know, I got the goat soup sweater, which is super rare. And, you know, so there's some, those things are the, you know, the fun ones to find.
What are some of your favorites? Mine would be like Van Halen, Fair Warning. That's a classic one.
Yeah.
I really love the AC/DC Back in Black because it was just the logo on the front and the back. It was the United States with the song titles in there. That's a
I love just the simple black on white. You know?
Right.
Those ones to me, like they always just, they just scream. But then, you know, there's so many, like I love old like Boston Tees, like the artwork that they had for those. There's just... There's so many bands that have artwork that maybe not even have anything to do with the band.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, too. I think, like, the Frizzelli image, like, there's probably been 20 bands that have used the same. They just, like, drop in place, like, bootleg the same, like, Frizzelli image on the front of the shirt.
That's
but it's
hilarious.
Still amazing, and it still looks right.
Yeah.
You
also do those 70s satin concert jackets. Which are insane, man. The tour jackets, they're almost like a disco jacket, right? What is the background on those? Like, I know the Stones had them. Like,
I mostly took it from that. I mean, it was like the tour jacket.
Yeah.
So it was more like the guys who worked
the crew.
Behind this, the crew. They were crew jackets. I could be wrong, but I've never seen them where they were like sold at a concert.
Yeah, me either.
They're almost always crew jackets.
Like there's a guy on eBay right now. He's been selling for about a year, and if I hit the lottery, I'm buying him. He's got the four Zeppelin ones.
Yeah, there's a collector who, like, that's his whole thing. I think he has a Twitter account, spacing out his name, but that's all he has is just all the like fish wraps, whatever you want to call them. They're like the silk tour jackets. There's not a lot.
There's not
that many out there. And the Stones, they just is more iconic because they've been photographed wearing them, you know, which is more rare. Floyd has a great one. Zeppelin has a few killer ones.
The four that the guy is selling on eBay, like $15,000. That's worth it to me, man. Like,
yeah, there's some. I mean, so for me, you know, it's another just iconic part of history is trying to make those again as sort of close to what they were.
I love that one-off merch. Like when Zeppelin played their last shows in America, Bill Graham made these Adidas sweatsuits for him.
Bill Graham was, I mean, listen.
He was a king.
I mean, that's one of my prizes. You know, I have a pretty good collection of old Winterland. And then I have, you know, the Bill Graham middle finger from the Fillmore West.
Yeah.
He made
great shit. Like,
everything.
I've got some of the stuff, like, they had softball and basketball teams, and I've got the basketball jersey.
Yeah.
Like, when a band would come to town, I got an AC/DC. It's a softball jersey, and it's from Back in Black, and it's, like, Bill Graham's team against them, you know?
I mean, he was it. I mean, he was the guy. I mean, for me, he's the guy who really put merch on the map. He's who did it, you know?
So. Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy, man. He really saw that guy. You know, he just passed away. It's like, I think it was like 25 or 20 years or whatever, a couple of days ago. And that guy really changed the game, you know? Like,
yeah, I mean, you still go on Wolfgang's Vault, like his collection. There's still
insane
stuff, all the stuff that he has, you know?
Yeah, that Wolfgang's Vault shit, man. You see some rare shit, like some old Montrose shirts.
It's not crazy expensive either.
You know,
that's what's amazing. Like, it's just kind of here it is. And he's had, you know, his archive's pretty amazing. And obviously all the old posters and so forth too that came out of those 600-700 posters or whatever.
Yeah, the posters are nuts. Now you make your own t-shirt
we're 100% American made. We make everything here in Los Angeles, from knitting our own fabric all the way through sewing and washing and printing, and it's all done.
How many shirts you think you made before you finally went, this is the fucking, the way it is? Like, were you making like hundreds and just going crazy?
I probably threw away 15,000 tees until we got like it right. And I'm still chasing it. Like, I still haven't like done the one where I'm like, this is it, you know?
Really?
So I'm still like chasing and like refining and stuff. But like, you know, even when you start washing and trying to like get it to break down the artwork right, break down the t-shirt right, you know, you're washing with stones. It's like figuring out like what size stones, and when the stones get too sharp they start making holes. And if you put on 100 t-shirts and instead of 150 t-shirts, like what does that do? I mean, you could experiment, you could go through 10,000 t-shirts just in washes in a week trying to figure out like the right chemistry of like, let's do this and getting all those things right. And you know, so that all that stuff was important to me.
God, that's fucking.
But I'm still chasing it. Like
I love you for that, man. Because who the fuck else would do that? You know what I mean? This would be a complete lost art. Yeah. And you get a guy like you that has crazy passion for it, and then you just go like, oh, fucking this. I mean, and hopefully you keep doing it because, I mean, you look around, you go, well, this guy can't be getting rich, you know, selling these shirts. Maybe.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a passion of love. This is a long-term conceptual idea. Made Warren is really about the craft and making of things on a much larger scale. The rock parts is just an element of it.
Yeah.
You know, we kind of trying to bring back that like pride and where people are proud of what they're making, proud of what they're buying and like, good product. I mean, I could go and, you know, whore this out all day long, day after day, and people are, you know, people are going and just taking it and dumping it down into the lower market every day and taking what we're doing. And it's fine, but you know, that's all their stuff is short term. You know?
Yeah.
They're building things that like, they're like this idea of like, I'm going to make $1 million in the next, like, great. But they're not, what are you going to do then?
Yeah.
You know? So
nobody's talking about it,
you know, like this is what I'm putting my name on, you know, so this is what I'm doing until, you know, I guess I can't do stuff anymore. So for me, I'm thinking 20, 30 years down the road, you know, I do this cause I love doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's
and
genius.
Like I said, I'm continuing to chase to make it better and more refined and even, you know, so that's, you know, that drive, you know, I'm not going to lose, you know, is there days where you're like, fuck, I don't want to Santee's anymore. Absolutely. But it's just, you know, but and maybe if I ever get that tail, it'll be something different, but I'm still like in hopes that I like, I'm sitting there at that one day and sand that tea. And I'm like, this is it. This is the one we're like putting behind glass.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I look back at even when we started, I'm like, damn, we were like, this is what we were putting out, you know? And I do that. Like now it's like every couple of weeks, I'm like, nah, this has gotta be better, you know? So that's what keeps me going.
Wow.
I know we can do it better. And I also like the form of teaching, like, you know, it's, you know, being able to like have, you know, guys to come in and work and seeing them and the excitement that they have and like teaching them. I mean, that's where, if this country's going to come back, it's going to have to work, you know? And
yep.
it's one of those things that you're like, yeah, you can't do it alone, but you can do a lot, you know? So I'm hoping that like, if nothing else, we just inspire people to like realize that they can do a lot, but you got to put in the work. There's nothing, you've been here or not, you've been here and see, there's nothing about this that's easy or glamorous. You got to put the work in.
You got to put anything.
That's, you have to be proud of what you're doing. So the reason I do it is because I'm proud of it. Like, I like it. I'm happy that it's put my name on it and put it out there. You know, the problem today is, you know, everyone's got like somebody that they can push it off on, you know?
Yeah,
I want all the responsibility. Like if I'm putting, like if there's some messed up, like then it's me. I'm not like saying it's this person over here screwing over this or this or that. Like I think that's what we have to get back. People have to like own their stuff, you know. So for me, I'm like, I'm trying to build something that I can own and be proud of, and you know, pass that on.
Now, other than the rock t-shirts, first of all, I want to describe a little bit about your place, because to me, this is the ultimate compound where you're at here. You're in Hollywood and it's about four buildings. I guess it used to be a recording studio.
Yeah. Yeah. It was Draco's recording studio for like 16 years. Like one of the, you know, most known like Latin and Puerto Rican. So it was that for, yeah, up until we took it over. And
And how'd you find the building? You're just
your luck. I mean, I was looking for space. I live on the West Side, so I was barely at that point ever even up in Hollywood. And I happened to be up here meeting a friend for breakfast on a Sunday, and drove by, and they were putting the sign up on the roof, and I owned it by the next day.
Wow!
And it was one of those, like, I was like relentless over to get.
You just walked in, you were like, "This is it."
I didn't even get to see it. I mean, I was like, I just saw the bones of it.
Uh-huh.
Because it was gated, and I saw the outside and the ability to build a world that we could basically do all of our aging and be outside. You know, we live in California and like, why be inside, you know?
Yeah.
So I built, you know, sort of wheat field in, you know, in the middle of Hollywood where we can kind of sit in this sort of magical little place that takes you, it makes it, you know, you don't feel like you're working as much, you know, it's not, it's like depressing, like sort of place.
Yeah. It's not a warehouse downtown.
Adult Disneyland place where we could go and kind of escape from.
It's incredible. Now, in this room we're in right here, it's pretty much, it's got some Mark Ryden stuff hung up, and it kind of reminds me of Mark Ryden's The Meat Show and stuff. Your taste and everything is exact to mine. Like, I could just move in here. Like, if you said, hey, I'm giving it up and I won the lottery, I'd go, well, I'll just take it here. And this here would be my house, this part, and the other side would be like motorcycles and cars, you know? I mean, it really is, awesome what you have in here, man. It's like, how long have you been into like art, like, of course, this kind of stuff, Mark Ryden, Robert Williams, Todd Shore, all that early kick-ass art? How long have you been into that?
Yeah, funny, you know, Mark Ryden, I started collecting, man, it's got to be 15-16 years ago. I mean, I'm bad with time, but
yeah.
Like, owning the Meat Magi, that was the painting I loved. That was, like, actually on my bucket list of, like, if I made some money, like, that was what I was going to get.
Yeah.
And I bought it back in the day for, like, $36,000, which was an insane amount of money. All the money that I, like, saved up, you know, at that time. And I was, like, it came up for sale, and I was, like, I'm buying it, you know? I was, like, it was like, and I was so happy that like I was able to like get that piece.
Wow. I remember Corky Ascends to Heaven was the piece I wanted.
So I had the two. So that was the choice between those two. The Corky was great because it was big.
Yeah.
It was a hard decision because I was like, man, like I can have this great big painting because most of his stuff was, you know, smaller.
Yeah.
And that was this great like 3-foot by 4-foot painting. And and I actually asked him for his opinion, and he was like, hey, you got it. Magi's like the icon of like, you know, sort of, so that's what I ended up going with. And
that's crazy.
And then I collected him, you know, pretty heavily over, you know, over many years after that. And,
yeah.
And became friends with him. And you know, for me, I really loved the idea of being able to, you know, cause I obviously love history and sort of all the antiquities. I like building these worlds where you could sort of mold those two things together, contemporary art and old things, and make it feel seamless. At that time I was getting pretty involved in like some of the museums around town, and it was just, to me, it was so departmentalized and kind of boring, and I wanted to curate space that kind of created a little bit more emotion, that sort of touched on all the senses, from scent and sound and all those things, and
yeah,
where you felt more encompassed into a world.
You really do.
That's
have
what
it.
This was, you know. I mean, I've always been in awe of like Disney's, like the thought that, like, you know, at that time period that he created this world and was able to build it, and that today it hasn't really changed, and people still go by the millions,
yeah,
to ride rides that are so outdated.
Totally.
And yet it's still a dream to everybody. Every child that goes there, it gets bit by the drug.
Yeah.
And to me, that's like, that gives me hope that the what we're doing here is not lost.
Yeah.
Technology has not replaced it. Disney is the antithesis of technology.
You're so right.
And it's the one place that people get off their ass, leave their computer, and actually go as a destination.
Yeah.
They pay ungodly amounts of money to go to ride stuff that's archaic.
Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. Yeah. Just like fucking, that thing could be anywhere else.
I mean,
and you wouldn't give a fuck about
it. You got black lights shining on some like old paintings that glow.
Yeah.
And they like click clank, and like you could, I mean, any set designer today could make it a billion, but no one messes with it.
Nope.
No one's ever gone and built a theme park to compete with Disney.
No.
So like, that's it. Like everyone, what an empire they've built.
It's crazy.
And it's all like built by hand. It's still automated, compressed air, like making everything.
Yeah,
move. And the irony is, it's like when you go through, it's a small world now. They'll occasionally put a new character, and the old stuff's so much better made.
Yeah,
it's so much cooler.
Yeah,
like the new stuff looks like it's made out of like toilet paper rolls.
Yeah,
I'm like, what happened to like, you know? Again, it was all that care.
Yeah,
and you see the new ones. Like you go in, and I think it's like the guy with the cowboy hat, whatever his name is. like they look janky compared to the stuff that was made 60 years ago there.
Yeah, like when they do the half and half on the Haunted Mansion, you know?
Yeah, the old stuff's so much cooler.
Yeah, yeah, I miss Country Bear Jamboree, man. Yeah,
Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, I'm sorry, but it was without him.
Yeah, fuck that new stuff on it. Yeah.
So anyway, that to me is, you know, it gives me all that reality of like when you go there, it's real. And you don't, it's all imagination because you go there, especially when you get old and you're like, God damn, all this shit was so much big. It seems so much bigger.
Yeah, totally.
But you still get caught up in it.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it's all the sensories. And that's where we've lost today. We spend so much time on the phone or like so forth and so on. And you don't get all
yeah.
that.
You don't get experience.
You don't get experience.
Because it's just a flat screen. Yeah.
So like, I know this whole virtual thing's coming and it's going to be, I'm sure it's going to be epic, but it's still not the experience.
No, nope.
Still not there with like family, friends, whatever it is. There's still going to be that part of you that needs that nurturing. You know,
like you and I can remember the first time we ever went to Disneyland. I can't remember the first time I was on a cell phone. You know what I mean? Like, it's just all a blur now because it's just so every year it's the newer, you know, and all that shit.
That's where you're talking concerts, you know. Yeah. There's this funny thing today where like you used to hold up a Bic lighter, now people are holding up their phone.
Yeah.
Instead of actually watching the concert, they're like recording the concert. I'm like, well, then you might as well just stay home at TV.
Yeah.
Like, you remember the concerts because you're there and you watch it and it's the sound and your ears ringing after you leave and like things you can't recreate.
Yeah.
You know, the dirt and like all the like stuff.
Yeah. And it's funny that you say that because I had Baron Woolman on and he shot Woodstock and he also shot Zeppelin and everybody. And he said, unfortunately, I don't remember any of the concerts because he was so engaged with shooting them. And I said, imagine that times 30,000 now. Everybody just film it. They don't even remember the concert. They're just going for the selfie to prove they were there.
Yeah.
They're not taking it in, you know? That's amazing. A famous Rolling Stone photographer said he didn't remember one concert because he was shooting it. And I was like, wow, that's the whole world now.
That is the whole world now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what you just said nails it. I mean, I have a friend who does a lot of that still today. And he's like, during, you know, concert X, he's like, I like logged. He's like, I ran 6 miles with my camera just capturing the footage of all they're trying to get to the right. They don't.
Yeah.
They're not getting any of it. That's a lot of people today. I mean, it's rare you see someone like not recording.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre because they're actually making sure on their screen that they're getting the right image. You might as well just watch the big jumbo screen.
Yeah.
They're like sitting in the front row and yet they're recording.
That's unbelievable, right?
It's like they're going to have Alzheimer's tomorrow and be like, man, I sure hope I have this video so I can remember what I saw last night.
And nobody ever watches it again.
No, they don't sit.
They don't go home and sit down and go, all right, let's fire up that Black Sabbath.
I can't wait to watch Stones now on my phone.
Yeah, yeah. No one watches that. It's insane.
No.
Now, you do, other than rock t-shirts, you have one wing here that has like leather jackets and boots and that kind of stuff. Now, what is that? You sell that stuff also?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have ready to wear ranging from denim through like suits and all that. But most of it's really built for clients coming in and being able to be a full tailored shop.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of costuming for a film. And then, like I said, for me, I get the enjoyment out of building one-off pieces. So that being able to work with a client and do sort of the old school form of tailoring is exciting to me. Picking out the fabrics that they want, and, you know, whether they want it aged or not aged and, you know, different time periods and so forth. It, you know, keeps it fresh. And collection today is, to me, it's just kind of a hot mess anyway. It's like, this, you know, no one's getting rich doing collections.
Yeah.
You know, like the big clothing companies today, it's like at the end of the day, they're making money off of their scent or like a sweater deal they did with Macy's.
Right.
The rest of it's all just storytelling.
Wow.
So for me, you know, we create those things to tell the story, but, you know, I like the actual process of, again, the intimacy with making the garment. Because that to me, like, once I'm done with the garment, like, I'm like, once whatever I make, you know, I don't get that attachment to it. My attachment's to the process.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy, like, I'm learning every day. I mean, we throw darts at a wall every day and make mistakes all the time to, like, learn what things do, you know? If we put this on this, what does it do? And if we put this on this and now light it on fire, what does that do? And so forth and so on. And, you know, after doing that for years and years and years, you start to, like, learn, okay, let's put all these elements together and see what it does. And you know, I think we've gotten a pretty good knowledge of, you know, at least how to, like, make things look authentic
on aging,
no matter
stuff
what it is.
That's interesting, because you worked on, I was around last year when you worked on my favorite film in the last 20 years, The Revenant.
Yeah.
Could be one of, I call it a masterpiece. It really blows my mind. And while I was here, I guess you did some of the clothes for it, right?
No, we actually did books. We made about 600 books by hand for them. It was basically, you know, I was brought in, Alejandro, I met with Alejandro, and he'd come to the space and just sort of, It obviously, when you know being at the space, you kind of understand. I grew up in Montana, that, you know, like, I have a home in the Bridger Mountains. So it was, when I was told the story of what they were going to be doing, they sort of heard about me later on into the movie. So mine was really more on the back end of what went out to, like, the Oscar voters and the foreign press and stuff, and, like, his personal things that he, like, gave out to you know, the cast and stuff, because, you know, it's like that was a 10-year sort of journey of his, and, you know, they filmed for 3 years. The cinematography in that will be unrivaled forever.
Yep.
And when you know the actual story of it, I mean, it's hard to capture all that stuff. And people, you know, a lot of people, even including myself, you know, when I saw the first edit, I was like, man, this, like, it seems a little, some of the stuff seems a bit far-fetched. But, you know, he studied so in-depthly, and his passion for what it was, and so being able to actually talk with him, and by the end of it, I had so much more understanding, respect of even just the people in that time period.
Wow.
I mean, they ended up finishing shooting that film in Argentina, and there's a tribe up there that's, like, hundreds of years old. It's still completely nude, and it's, like, sub-zero, you know? And
they live shit.
Completely nude out in that. And it's that, you know, back then, it's like, that's, you realize how, like, dummied down we've gotten. You know, yeah. You've got survivalists today. They're not survivalists, you know. Back then, you wouldn't have any other option.
Yeah,
you know, like, you're out in nowhere. You're drinking the river water that now, like, there wasn't the pollutants and things then, but everything was different. You know, your life expectancy was different. Everything was different. So, you know, being able to be a part of that, and then taking the care into, like, making these books. So, I mean, that was probably, there's probably a few things in my life that I've took more passion and time into than the actual process of hand making all those. So, I mean, those actually never left this site. The binding, everything was done by hand here. Did all the daguerreotype work here. The paper alone went through, like, 7 stages of aging and
wow.
So forth. And that was, like, 3 months of my life, 18 hours a day to basically
holy
do those.
Shit.
Yeah.
Now, those books, what was in the books? Was it the story of the...
Yeah, so, yeah, it was some of the story. It was really to kind of, like, give, you know, there's always, everyone always sends out swag, especially around Oscar season. Everyone's sending out their swag,
right,
trying to, like, get people excited. And most of it's garbage. People paying a ton of money for it. And I'm like, I saw some of the swag, and I was just like, why would you know, I was like, for this film, like, you got to create something that, like, someone never's going to want to throw away. It's like that, like, it feels like it came. I mean, every book got smoked. I mean, we put them in smokers and actually smoked them. So they had the, like, scent,
wow,
of being, what it was. It had real human hair. And I mean, it was like, I wanted something that people, like, treasured and didn't just grab and everyone's short attention span threw it away. I wanted people to be like, holy shit. Like, you know, everyone was unique. I mean, it's like, so everyone got something. It was like a piece of art. That's what that film felt like to me. It had that care in it. So, yeah, that was another one. It's like, you know, Detroit. I use Detroit. You know, we're getting ready to build a distillery in Pontiac. And Detroit, obviously, is the sort of, to me, the spine of the country. And it was a time period where people were, you know, when we were making cars and people were on production lines, it wasn't about the money.
Yeah.
People were proud to be in this country. They were proud that they were making something. They were proud of what it was. And certain things, like, you have to put the money thing. Money's not making people happy. Like the Revenant thing, like in the end, the time period, I made 10 cents an hour.
Yeah. You
know, it wasn't about that. It was about making something that, like, that made me, like, I'll never forget that experience. You know, I'm insanely proud of what those things were. And to be a part of that film.
God, that film.
So that's a lot of what we do here too. It's like, sure, the business has to make money and all those things. But money's always going to come. If you're doing the right thing, the money's going to be there. And in a much larger scale than it's ever going to be doing these flash in the pants,
yeah,
one-off gimmick thing.
Cash grabs.
Because those things are never your thing. Anybody who's passionate about something, it's something that they created. The people who are flash in the pants, they're stealing an idea and they're just taking it somewhere else to use. That's what I found. So most of these things that are just like these like trends and things, they're just people who are out looking and trying to be like, you know what, we can do that for 5 cents less.
Yeah,
I'll do it and put it here.
Yeah,
and
fuck that.
We're gonna make X over, and then they're back to like trying to find that again. Like to me, like I don't know how. I don't think these people are happy.
Yeah. Oh, you've made me extremely happy, dude. When I came in here, I feel like I'm a kid in the candy store. When I went into the actual room with the t-shirts, I just started losing my mind, actually. It was almost a sensory overload because it was in my life, I've searched for the ultimate leather jacket, the ultimate fucking boots, the ultimate denim, the ultimate watch. I'm always, and I think it's passion that drives me, and I love that stuff. Like, oh my God. So when I walked in here, I was like, I can't even fucking believe this place exists. You know, and it's something I ride by every day, just meow. And then little did I know, inside there is a gold mine of rock t-shirts that will make you happy. And man, yesterday as I put this shirt on, I took a picture of it and put it on Instagram, everybody going crazy, you know? I gotta say, you are definitely the definition of handmade, and you are like exactly the idea I had when I thought of doing this series on the podcast. And I love everything you do, and I just think that you're a special person, man. I just think it's fucking so cool that somebody takes the time to make a rock t-shirt, you know? And I want to thank you for it, man. It's just great.
Thank you.
Where can the people get your shirts? Now, before I go any further, the shirts are pricey. There's going to be people on here that are going to be like, whoa, what the fuck? But if you look at the 20 shirts you bought over the last 10 years, and they don't mean shit to you for, let's say, 40 or 50 or even 20 a piece, if you buy one of your shirts, it's going to fucking be so next level and cool to you every time I put this on. Like, I'm going to wear this the whole week. You know what I mean? That's how I am. I put a shirt on. I'm even afraid to wear deodorant with it. I don't want it to fuck up, you know, the deodorant stain. I'm like, this thing's God.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we're trying to make things that people like, you know, it becomes their favorite. You know, that's always been the idea. You don't take it off, you know?
Yeah.
Wear it.
Where do they get it?
I mean, you know, we're in... the Barneys, the Ron Robinsons, the like Net-a-Porter's, you know, that sort of, you know, as you said, you know, it's a little bit pricier good, and the price is really in the fact that there's no corners cut.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all done by hand. And
I seen it right here.
Yeah. So, you know, eventually, you know, we're working on putting out a tee that will actually be able to work with bands to take out on tour, because that too, I think, you know, building relationships with bands and hearing, you know, a lot of them don't have much control over their merch. You know, it's you know, they've handed off to someone else, and someone else is kind of overseeing that. And most of the time, they're not very happy with the art that's out there. And so, in that, you know, the fans aren't very happy either. You know, I mean, we've all gone to enough concerts, and half the time, the bootlegs are better than what's in the inside.
Yeah, you guys are going to be doing my shirts.
So for me, like, I wanted to be able to give that back to, especially the tour, and actually put out a tee that like you want to take home and you're like, you're stoked on again, and you're not just buying this piece of crap that, like, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be, you know, it's like, again, the expense is not just to make money. The expense
is in the creativity. So you can give the same tea at the $40 that's going today that is far superior to what's out there, and it's not costing anything more to make that. It's just creatively having less hands in the pocket.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm working on that and being able to obviously give to that other, you know, this, like I said, this is, to me, is really more of an enjoyment project, and the tees are really more piece of art. They are all unique. I mean, you know, they're all sanded by hand. So it's, you know, you said it best. It's like, do you want 10 of something you don't love, or do you want one of something that...
Totally.
Everyone, we live in a world of excess, and Made Warren's not about excess.
Yeah.
You know, Made Warren's about like saving up and having something that like you actually love and you wear all the time, instead of something that you just, you know, saw and were like, oh, cool, that's $20. Look, it's only $20. That's where we've gotten.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you love it. It's just like,
yeah, it's only 20.
It's only 20. It's fine. Yeah, I'll just take it.
My goal is to have,
I'll wear it, but it's just, you know, it's $20.
My goal is to have one of each. Man, that'll be my outfit. Like, I figured if I had one of each, I would never need to buy another. It's funny because I've got I've got about 150 t-shirts in my house.
Yeah.
As I moved and I was washing them, I lost weight and I got to get rid of all these. I want to have like 20 Primo shirts and get rid of just...
I own the company. And yeah. I have five black blank Made Warren tees, and that's all I wear. I'm all holy now because it's like, it's what I wear every day.
I love it.
You know, it's like, I don't, you know, I mean, so for me, you don't need a lot.
What's this, is this your signature, that seam that comes off?
Yeah, it's a complicated stitch. So yeah. I wanted, you know, it was something I wanted to put on just to kind of gave us a bit of a...
I love it because there's another way I know it's your shirt, you know?
Yeah, that definitely sets it. It's not a lot of those machines that can do that. So it's, yeah.
Now you got an Instagram, and I really wish, and I would do it for you, if we could take a picture of each fucking shirt and put it on. Well,
we're getting ready to go live with e-commerce. So at that point, cool. You'll be able to actually go on the site.
Yeah.
And so we're going to go live with that. And then I'm also building it as a like DIY, like a do-it-yourself website. So, you know, in a short period of time, you'll actually be able to go on and you'll have basically a blank slate, whether it's just like a blank jacket or a blank sweatshirt. And you'll have all kinds of things to choose from, and you can go on and custom make it however you want, and then we'll make it and send it to you.
Wow.
So, I like the, since we're crafting everything here, I think, you know, it's fitting, at least from, let's say, social media e-commerce point, that like people can get, feel like they're also a part of crafting however they're doing it as well. So in the process of building that at this moment as well. So, because I think that's kind of a cool little, you know, way too, that people can get more involved and understand kind of what we do.
I'm looking forward to working with you on a couple shirts. I can't wait, man. Because
me as well.
The dream. You're like the dream guy for me, man. Now let's give them your Instagram.
Yeah, it's just Made Warren.
Made Warren. And then you got a Twitter or anything, or a Facebook?
I got Facebook. Facebook's Made Warren as well. So yep. Everything's under just straight Made Warren.
And people can get them at like the t-shirts at Barney's. Are they at Barney's now?
They're at Barney's now, yeah.
Yeah, man. At Barney's New York, Barney's LA. And then can they order them on a website in the future?
Yeah. So we'll be going live with e-commerce on Made Warren in like 14 days, 14 to, 2 weeks to 3 weeks. We'll be live finally. And then.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't thank you enough for having me over here and doing the show, man. I just love your taste is just fucking impeccable, and everything here is just awesome.
Thank
you so much for doing the show. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and make sure you check them out on Instagram right away. See you guys.